5. Peter Egon Momus was doing them a great honour. Peter Egon Momus was deigning to share with them his visions for the new high city. Peter Egon Momus, architect designate for the 63rd expedition, was unveiling his preparatory ideas for the transformation of the conquered city into a permanent memorial to glory and compliance. The trouble was, Peter Egon Momus was just a figure in the distance and largely inaudible. In the gathered audience, in the dusty heat, Ignace Carcassi shifted impatiently and craned his neck to see. The assembly had been gathered in a city square north of the palace. It was just after midday, and the sun was at its zenith, scorching the bare basalt towers and yards of the city. Though the high walls around the square offered some shade, the air was oven-dry and stiflingly hot. There was a breeze, but even that was heated like exhaust vapour, and it did nothing but stir up fine grit in the air. Powder dust, the particulate residue of the great battle, was everywhere, hazing the bright air like smoke. Carcassi's throat was as arid as a riverbed in drought. Around him, people in the crowd coughed and sneezed. The crowd, 500 strong, had been carefully vetted. Three-quarters of them were local dignitaries, grandees, nobles, merchants, members of the overthrown government, representatives of that part of 6319's ruling classes who had pledged compliance to the new order. They had been summoned by invitation, so that they might participate, however superficially, in the renewal of their society. The rest were remembrances. Many of them, like Carcassi, had been granted their first transit permit to the surface, at long last, so they could attend. If this was what he had been waiting for, Carcassi thought, they could keep it. Standing in a crowded kiln while some old fart made incoherent noises in the background. The crowd seemed to share his mood. They were hot and despondent. Carcassi saw no smiles on the faces of the invited locals, just hard-drawn looks of forbearance. The choice between compliance or death didn't make compliance any more pleasurable. They were defeated, deprived of their culture and their way of life, facing a future determined by alien minds. They were simply, wearily, enduring the indignity of this period of transition into the Imperium of Man. From time to time, they clapped in a desultory manner, but only when stirred up by the iterators carefully planted in their midst. The crowd had drawn up around the aprons of a metal stage erected for the event. Upon it were arranged hololithic screens and relief models of the city to be, as well as many of the extravagantly complex brass and steel surveying instruments Momus utilized in his work. Geared, spoked, and meticulous, the instruments suggested to Carcass's mind devices of torture. Torture was right. Momus, when he could be seen between the heads of the crowd, was a small, trim man with over-dainty mannerisms. As he explained his plans, the staff of iterators on stage with him aimed live pictures close up at relevant areas of the relief models, the images transferring directly to the screens, along with graphic schematics. But the sunlight was too glaring for decent hololithic projection, and the images were milked out and hard to comprehend. Something was wrong with the vox mic Momus was using, too, and what little of his speech came through served only to demonstrate the man had no gift whatsoever for public speaking. "Always a heliolithic city, a tribute to the sun above, and we may see this afternoon, indeed, I am sure you will have noticed, the glory of the light here. A city of light. Light out of darkness is a noble theme, by which, of course, I mean the light of truth, shining upon the darkness of ignorance. I am much taken with the local phototropic technologies I have found here, and intend to incorporate them into the design." Carcassi sighed. He never thought he would find himself wishing for an iterator, but at least those bastards knew how to speak in public. Peter Egon Momus should have left the talking to one of the iterators while he aimed the wretched Pictor one for them. His mind wandered. He looked up at the high walls around them, geometric slabs against the blue sky, baked pink in the sunlight, or smoke black where shadows slanted. He saw the scorch marks and dotted bolt craters that pitted the basalt like acne. Beyond the walls, the towers of the palace were in worse repair, their plasterwork hanging off like shed snakeskin, their missing windows like blinded eyes. In a yard to the south of the gathering, a titan of the Mechanicum stood on station, its grim humanoid form rising up over the walls. It stood perfectly still, like a piece of monumental martial statuary, instantly installed. Now that, thought Carcassy, was a far more appropriate celebration of glory and compliance. Carcassy stared at the Titan for a little while. He'd never seen anything like it before in his life, except in Picts. The awesome sight of it almost made the tedious outing worthwhile. The more he stared at it, the more uncomfortable it made him feel. It was so huge, so threatening, and so very still. He knew it could move. He began to wish it would. He found himself yearning for it to suddenly turn its head, or take a step, or otherwise rumble into animation. Its immobility was agonizing. Then he began to fear that if it did suddenly move, he would be quite unmanned, and might be forced to cry out in involuntary terror and fall to his knees. A burst of clapping made him jump. Momus had apparently said something apposite, and the iterators were stirring up the crowd in response. Carcassy slapped his sweaty hands together a few times, obediently. Carcassy was sick of it. He knew he couldn't bear to stand there much longer with the Titan staring at him. He took one last look at the stage. Momus was rambling on, well into his 50th minute. The only other point of interest to the whole affair, as far as Carcassy was concerned, stood at the back of the podium behind Momus. Two giants in yellow plate. Two noble Astartes from the 7th Legion, the Imperial Fists, the Emperor's Praetorians. They were presumably in attendance to lend Momus an appropriate air of authority. Carcassy guessed the 7th had been chosen over the Lunar Wolves because of their noted genius in the arts of fortification and defence. The Imperial Fists were fortress builders, warrior masons who raised such impenetrable redoubts that they could be held for eternity against any enemy. Carcassy smelled the artful handiwork of iterator propaganda, the architects of war watching over the architect of peace. Carcassy had waited to see if either would speak, or come forward to remark upon Momus's plans. But they did not. They stood there, bolters across their broad chests, as static and unwavering as the Titan. Carcassy turned away, and began to push his way out through the inflexible crowd. He headed towards the rear of the square. Troopers of the Imperial Army had been stationed around the hem of the crowd as a precaution. They had been required to wear full-dress uniform, and they were so overheated that their sweaty cheeks were blanched as sickly green-white. One of them noticed Carcassy moving out through the thinnest part of the audience and came over to him.
"Where are you going, sir?" he asked.
"I'm dying of thirst," Carcassy replied.
"There will be refreshments, I'm told, after the presentation," the soldier said.
His voice caught on the word refreshments, and Carcassy knew there would be none for the common soldiery. "Well, I've had enough," Carcassy said.
"It's not over."
"I've had enough." The soldier frowned. Perspiration beaded at the bridge of his nose, just beneath the rim of his heavy fur shaker. His throat and jowls were flushed pink and sheened with sweat.
"I can't allow you to wander away. Movement is supposed to be restricted to approved areas."
Carcassy grinned wickedly. "And I thought you were here to keep trouble out, not keep us in." The soldier didn't find that funny, or even ironic.
"We're here to keep you safe, sir," he said. "I'd like to see your permit."
Carcassy took out his papers. They were an untidy, crumpled bundle, warm and damp from his trouser pocket. Carcassy waited, faintly embarrassed, while the soldier studied them. He had never liked barking up against authority, especially not in front of people, though the back of the crowd didn't seem to be at all interested in the exchange.
"You're a remembrancer?" the soldier asked.
"Yes. Poet," Carcassy added before the inevitable second question got asked. The soldier looked up from the papers into Carcassy's face, as if searching for some essential characteristic of poethood that might be discerned there, comparable to a navigator's third eye or a slave drone's serial tattoo. He'd likely never seen a poet before, which was all right, because Carcassy had never seen a Titan before.
"You should stay here, sir,"
the soldier said, handing the papers back to Carcassy.
"But this is pointless," Carcassy said.
I have been sent to make a memorial of these events. I can't get close to anything. I can't even hear properly what that fool's got to say. Can you imagine the wrong-headedness of this? Momus isn't even history. He's just another kind of memorialist. I've been allowed here to remember his remembrance, and I can't even do that properly. I'm so far removed from the things I should be engaging with. I might as well have stayed on Terra and made do with a telescope. The soldier shrugged. He'd lost the thread of Carcass's speech early on.
You should stay here, sir, for your own safety.
I was told the city had been made safe, Carcass said. We're only a day or two from compliance, aren't we?
The soldier leaned forward discreetly, so close that Carcass could smell the stale odour of garbage the heat was infusing into his breath. Just between us, that's the official line, but there has been trouble. Insurgents. Loyalists. You always get it in a conquered city, no matter how clean the victory. The back streets are not secure.
Really?
They're saying loyalists, but it's just discontent, if you ask me. These bastards have lost it all, and they're not happy about it.
Carcass nodded. Thanks for the tip, he said,
and turned back to rejoin the crowd.
5 minutes later, with Momus still droning on and Carcass close to despair, an elderly noblewoman in the crowd fainted, and there was a small commotion.
The soldiers hurried in to take charge of the situation and carry her into the shade.
When the soldier's back was turned, Carcass took himself off out of the square and into the streets beyond. He walked for a while through empty courts and high-walled streets where shadows pooled like water. The day's heat was still pitiless, but moving around made it more bearable. Periodic breezes gusted down alleyways, but they were not at all relieving. Most were so full of sand and grit that Carcass had to turn his back to them and close his eyes until they abated. The streets were vacant, except for an occasional figure hunched in the shadows of a doorway or half visible behind broken shutters. He wondered if anybody would respond if he approached them, but felt reluctant to try. The silence was penetrating, and to break it would have felt as improper as disturbing a morning vigil. He was alone, properly alone for the first time in over a year, a master of his own actions. It felt tremendously liberating. He could go where he pleased, and quickly began to exercise that privilege, taking street turns at random, walking where his feet took him. For a while he kept the still unmoving Titan in sight, as a point of reference, but it was soon eclipsed by towers and high roofs, so he resigned himself to getting lost. Getting lost would be liberating, too. There were always the great towers of the palace. He could follow those back to their roots if necessary. War had ravaged many parts of the city he passed through. Buildings had toppled into white and dusty heaps of slag, or been reduced to their very basements. Others were roofless, or burned out, or wounded in their structures, or simply rendered into facades, their innards blown out, standing like the wooden flats of stage scenery. Craters and shell holes pockmarked certain pavements, or the surfaces of metalled roads, sometimes forming strange rows and patterns, as if their arrangement was deliberate or concealed by some secret code, great truths of life and death. There was a smell in the dry, hot air, like burning, or blood, or ordure. Yet none of those things. A mingled scent. An after-scent. It wasn't burning he could smell. It was things burnt. It wasn't blood. It was dry residue. It wasn't ordure. It was the seeping consequence of sewer systems broken and cracked by the bombardment. Many streets had stacks of belongings piled up along the pavements. Furniture, bundles of clothing, kitchenware. A great deal of it was in disrepair, and had evidently been recovered from ruined dwellings. Other piles seemed more intact, the items carefully packed in trunks and coffers. People were intending to quit the city, he realized. They had piled up their possessions in readiness while they tried to procure transportation, or perhaps the relevant permission from the occupying authorities. Almost every street and yard bore some slogan or other notice upon its walls. All were handwritten, in a great variety of styles and degrees of calligraphic skill. Some were daubed in pitch, others paint or dye, others chalk or charcoal. The latter, Carcass reasoned, marks made by the employment of burnt sticks and splinters taken from the ruins. Many were indecipherable or unfathomable. Many were bold, angry graffiti, splenetically cursing the invaders or defiantly announcing a surviving spark of resistance. They called for death, for uprising, for revenge. Others were lists, carefully recording the names of the citizens who had died in that place, or plaintive requests for news about the missing loved ones listed below. Others were agonized statements of lament, or minutely and delicately transcribed texts of some sacred significance. Carcassi found himself increasingly captivated by them, by the variation and contrast of them, and the emotions they conveyed. For the first time, the first true and proper time since he'd left Terra, he felt the poet in him respond. This feeling excited him. He had begun to fear that he might have accidentally left his poetry behind on Terra in his hurry to embark, or at least that it malingered, folded and unpacked, in his quarters on the ship, like his least favourite shirt. He felt the muse return, and it made him smile, despite the heat and the mummification of his throat. It seemed apt, after all, that it should be words that brought words back into his mind. He took out his chapbook and his pen. He was a man of traditional inclinations, believing that no great lyric could ever be composed on the screen of a data slate, a point of variance that had almost got him into a fist fight with Palissad Hadre, the other poet of note amongst the Remembrancer group. That had been near the start of their conveyance to join the expedition, during one of the informal dinners held to allow the Remembrancers to get to know one another. He would have won the fight, if it had come to it. He was fairly sure of that. Even though Hadre was an especially large and fierce woman. Carcassi favoured notebooks of thick, cream cartridge paper, and at the start of his long-fated career had sourced a supplier in one of Terra's Arctic hives, who specialised in antique methods of paper manufacture. The firm was called Bondsman, and it offered a particularly pleasing quarto chapbook of 50 leaves. Bound in a case of soft black kid, with an elasticated strap to keep it closed. The Bondsman number 7. Carcassi, a sallow, raw-headed youth back then, had paid a significant proportion of his first royalty income for an order of 200. The volumes had come, packed head to toe, in a waxed box lined with tissue paper, which had smelled, to him at least, of genius and potential. He had used the books sparingly, leaving not one precious page unfilled before starting a new one. As his fame grew and his earnings soared, he had often thought about ordering another box, but always stopped when he realized he had over half the original shipment still to use up. All his great works had been composed upon the pages of Bondsman number 7's. His Fanfare to Unity, all 11 of his Imperial Cantos, his Ocean Poems, even the meritorious much-republished Reflections and Odes, written in his 30th year, which had secured his reputation and won him the Ethiopic Laureate. The year before his selection to the role of Remembrancer, after what had been, in all fairness, a decade of unproductive doldrums that had seen him living off past glories, he had decided to rejuvenate his muse by placing an order for another box. He had been dismayed to discover that Bondsman had ceased operation. Ignace Carcassi had 9 unused volumes left in his possession. He had brought them all with him on the voyage. But for an idiot scribble or two, their pages were unmarked. On a blazing, dusty street corner in the broken city, he took the chapbook out of his coat pocket and slid off the strap. He found his pen, an antique plunger action fountain, for his traditionalist tastes applied as much to the means of marking as what should be marked, and began to write. The heat had almost congealed the ink in his nib, but he wrote anyway, copying out such pieces of wall writing as affected him, sometimes attempting to duplicate the manner and form of their delineation. He recorded 1 or 2 at first, as he moved from street to street, and then became more inclusive, and began to mark down almost every slogan he saw. It gave him satisfaction and delight to do this. He could feel, quite definitely, a lyric beginning to form, taking shape from the words he read and recorded. It would be superlative. After years of absence, the muse had flown back into his soul, as if it had never been away. He realized he had lost track of time. Though it was still stifling hot and bright, the hour was late, and the blazing sun had worked its way over, lower in the sky. He had filled almost 20 pages, almost half his chapbook. He felt a sudden pang. What if he only had 9 volumes of genius left in him? What if that box of Bondsman number 7s, delivered so long ago, represented the creative limits of his career? He shuddered, chilled despite the clinging heat, and put his chapbook and pen away. He was standing on a lonely war-scab street corner, persecuted by the sun, unable to fathom which direction to turn. For the first time since escaping Peter Egon Momus's presentation, Carcassy felt afraid. He felt that eyes were watching him from the blind ruins. He began to retrace his steps, slouching through gritty shadow and dusty light. Only once or twice did a new graffito persuade him to stop and take out his chapbook again. He'd been walking for some time, in circles probably, for all the streets had begun to look the same, when he found the eating house. It occupied the ground floor and basement of a large basalt tenement, and bore no sign, but the smell of cooking announced its purpose. Door shutters had been opened onto the street, and there was a handful of tables set out. For the first time, he saw people in numbers. Locals, in dark sun cloaks and shawls, as unresponsive and indolent as the few souls he had glimpsed in doorways. They were sitting at the tables under a tattered awning, alone or in small silent groups, drinking thimble glasses of liquor or eating food from finger bowls. Carcassy remembered the state of his throat, and his belly remembered itself with a groan. He walked inside, into the shade, nodding politely to the patrons. None responded. In the cold gloom he found a wooden bar with a dresser behind it, laden with glassware and spouted bottles. The hostel keeper, an old woman in a khaki wrap, eyed him suspiciously from behind the serving counter. "Hello," he said. She frowned back. "Do you understand me?" he asked. She nodded slowly. "That's good. Very good. I had been told our languages were largely the same, but that there were some accent and dialect differences." He trailed off. The old woman said something that might have been "what?" or might have been any number of curses or interrogatives. "You have food?" he asked. Then he mimed eating. She continued to stare at him. "Food?" he asked. She replied with a flurry of guttural words, none of which he could make out. Either she didn't have food, or was unwilling to serve him, or she didn't have any food for the likes of him. "Something to drink, then?" he asked. No response. He mimed drinking, and when that brought nothing, pointed at the bottles behind her. She turned and took down one of the glass containers, selecting one as if he had indicated it directly instead of generally. It was 3/4 full of a clear, oily fluid that roiled in the gloom. She thumped it onto the counter, and then put a thimble glass beside it. "Very good," he smiled. "Very, very good. Well done. Is this local?" "Of course it is, of course it is. A local speciality." "You're not going to tell me, are you? Because you have no idea what I'm actually saying, have you?" She stared blankly at him. He picked up the bottle and poured a measure into the glass. The liquor flowed as slowly and heavily through the spout as his ink had done from his pen in the street. He put the bottle down and lifted the glass, toasting her. "Your health," he said brightly, "and to the prosperity of your world. I know things are hard now, but trust me, this is all for the best. All for the very best." He swigged the drink. It tasted of licorice, and went down very well, heating his dry gullet and lighting a buzz in his gut. "Excellent," he said, and poured himself a second. "Very good indeed. You're not going to answer me, are you? I could ask your name and your lineage and anything at all, and you would just stand there like a statue, wouldn't you? Like a titan." He sank the second glass and poured a third. He felt very good about himself now, better than he had done for hours, better even than when the muse had flown back to him in the streets. In truth, Drink had always been a more welcome companion to Ignace Carcassi than any muse, though he would never have been willing to admit it, or to admit the fact that his affection for drink had long weighed down his career, like rocks in a sack. Drink and his muse, both beloved of him, each pulling in opposite directions. He drank his third glass and tipped out a fourth. Warmth infused him, a biological warmth much more welcome than the brutal heat of the day. It made him smile. It revealed to him how extraordinary this false terror was, how complex and intoxicating. He felt love for it, and pity, and tremendous goodwill. This world, this place, this hostelry would not be forgotten. Suddenly remembering something else, he apologized to the old woman, who had remained facing him across the counter like a fugued servitor, and reached into his pocket. He had currency, imperial coin, and plastic wafers. He made a pile of them on the stained and glossy bar top. "Imperial," he said. "But you take that. I mean, you're obliged to. I was told that by the iterators this morning. Imperial currency is legal tender now, to replace your local coin." "Terra, you don't know what I'm saying, do you? How much do I owe you?" No answer. He sipped his fourth drink and pushed the pile of cash towards her. "You decide, then. You tell me. Take for the whole bottle." He tapped the finger against the side of the flask. "The whole bottle? How much?" He grinned and nodded at the money. The old woman looked at the heap, reached out a bony hand, and picked up a 5 aquila piece. She studied it for a moment, then spat on it and threw it at Carcassi. The coin bounced off his belly and fell onto the floor. Carcassi blinked and then laughed. The laughter boomed out of him, hard and joyous, and he was quite unable to keep it in. The old woman stared at him. Her eyes widened ever so slightly. Carcassi lifted up the bottle and the glass. "I tell you what," he said. "Keep it all. All of it." He walked away and found an empty table in the corner of the place. He sat down and poured another drink, looking about him. Some of the silent patrons were staring at him. He nodded back, cheerfully. They looked so human, he thought, and realized it was a ridiculous thing to think, because they were without a doubt human. But at the same time they weren't. Their drab clothes, their drab manner, the set of their features, their way of sitting and looking and eating. They seemed a little like animals, man-shaped creatures, trained to ape human behavior, yet not quite accomplished in that art. "Is that what 5,000 years of separation does to a species?" he asked aloud. No one answered, and some of his watchers turned away. Was that what 5,000 years did to the divided branches of mankind? He took another sip. Biologically identical, but for a few strands of genetic inheritance, and yet culturally grown so far apart. These were men who lived and walked and drank and shat just as he did. They lived in houses and raised cities and wrote upon walls and even spoke the same language, old women notwithstanding. Yet time and division had grown them along alternate paths. Carcassi saw that clearly now. They were a graft from the rootstock, grown under another sun, similar yet alien. Even the way they sat at tables and sipped at drinks. Carcassi stood up suddenly. The muse had abruptly jostled the pleasure of drink out of the summit of his mind. He bowed to the old woman as he collected up his glass and two-thirds empty bottle and said, "My thanks, madam." Then he teetered back out into the sunlight. He found a vacant lot a few streets away that had been levelled to rubble by bombing, and perched himself on a chunk of basalt. Setting down the bottle and the glass carefully, he took out his half-filled bondsman number 7 and began to write again, forming the first few stanzas of a lyric that owed much to the writings on the walls and the insight he had garnered in the hostelry. It flowed well for a while, and then dried up. He took another drink, trying to restart his inner voice. Tiny black ant-like insects milled industriously in the rubble around him, as if trying to rebuild their own miniature lost city. He had to brush one off the open page of his chapbook. Others raced exploratively over the toe-caps of his boots in a frenetic expedition. He stood up, imagining itches, and decided this wasn't a place to sit. He gathered up his bottle and his glass, taking another sip once he'd fished out the ant floating in it with his finger. A building of considerable size and magnificence faced him across the damaged lot. He wondered what it was. He stumbled over the rubble towards it, almost losing his footing on the loose rock from time to time. What was it? A municipal hall? A library? A school? He wandered around it, admiring the fine rise of the walls and the decorated headers of the stonework. Whatever it was, the building was important. Miraculously, it had been spared the destruction visited on its neighbouring lots. Carcassy found the entrance, a towering arch of stone filled with copper doors. They weren't locked. He pushed his way in. The interior of the building was so profoundly and refreshingly cool it almost made him gasp. It was a single space, an arched roof raised on massive ouslite pillars, the floor dressed in cold onyx. Under the end windows some kind of stone structure rose. Carcassy paused. He put down his bottle beside the base of one of the pillars and advanced down the centre of the building with his glass in his hand. He knew there was a word for a place like this. He searched for it. Sunlight, filleted by coloured glass, slanted through the thin windows. The stone structure at the end of the chamber was a carved lectern, supporting a very massive and very old book. Carcassy touched the crinkled parchment of the book's open pages with delight. It appealed to him the same way as the pages of a Bondsman No. 7 did. The sheets were old and faded, covered with ornate black script and hand-coloured images. This was an altar, he realized. This place, a temple, a fane.
Terra alive, he declared,
and then winced as his words echoed back down the cool vault. History had taught him about fanes and religious belief, but he had never before set foot inside such a place of spirits and divinity. He sensed that the spirits were looking down on his intrusion with disapproval, and then laughed at his own idiocy. There were no spirits, not anywhere in the cosmos. Imperial truth had taught him that. The only spirits in this building were the ones in his glass and his belly. He looked at the pages again. Here was the truth of it, the crucial mark of difference between his breed of man and the local variety. They were heathens. They continued to embrace the superstitions that the fundamental strand of mankind had set aside. Here was the promise of an afterlife and an ethereal world. Here was the nonsense of a faith in the intangible. Carcassy knew that there were some, many, perhaps, amongst the population of the compliant Imperium who longed for a return to those ways. God, in every incarnation and pantheon, was long perished, but still men hankered after the ineffable. Despite prosecution, new credos and budding religions were sprouting up amongst the cultures of unified man. Most vigorous of all was the imperial creed that insisted humanity adopt the emperor as a divine being, a god-emperor of mankind. The idea was ludicrous and, officially, heretical. The emperor had always refused such adoration in the most stringent terms, denying his apotheosis. Some said it would only happen after his death, and as he was functionally immortal, that tended to cap the argument. Whatever his powers, whatever his capacity, whatever his magnificence as the finest and most gloriously total leader of the species, he was still just a man. The emperor liked to remind mankind of this whenever he could. It was an edict that rattled around the bureaucracies of the expanding Imperium. The emperor is the emperor, and he is great and everlasting, but he is not a god, and he refuses any worship offered to him. Carcassy took a swig and put his empty thimble glass down at an angle on the edge of the lectern shelf. The Lectitio Divinitatis, that's what it was called. The missal of the underground wellspring that strove in secret to establish the cult of the emperor against his will. It was said that even some of the upstanding members of the Council of Terror supported its aims. The Emperor as God. Carcassi stifled a laugh. 5,000 years of blood, war, and fire to expunge all gods from the culture, and now the man who achieved that goal supplants them as a new deity. How foolish is mankind! Carcassi laughed, enjoying the way his words echoed around the empty fane. How desperate and flailing! Is it that we simply need a concept of God to fulfill us? Is that part of our make-up? He fell silent, considering the point he had raised to himself. A good point. Well reasoned. He wondered where his bottle had gone. It was a good point. Maybe that was mankind's ultimate weakness. Maybe it was one of humanity's basic impulses, the need to believe in another higher order. Perhaps faith was like a vacuum, sucking up credulity in a frantic effort to fill its own void. Perhaps it was a part of mankind's genetic character to need, to hunger for, a spiritual solace. Perhaps we are cursed, Carcassi told the empty fane, to crave something which does not exist. There are no gods, no spirits, no demons. So we make them up, to comfort ourselves. The fane seemed oblivious to his ramblings. He took hold of his empty glass and wandered back to where he had left the bottle. Another drink. He left the fane and threaded his way out into the blinding sunlight. The heat was so intense that he had to take another swig. Carcassi wobbled down a few streets, away from the temple, and heard a rushing, roasting noise. He discovered a team of imperial soldiers, stripped to the waist, using a flamer to erase anti-imperial slogans from a wall. They had evidently been working their way down the street, for all the walls displayed swathes of heat burns. "Don't do that," he said. The soldiers turned and looked at him, their flamer spitting. From his garments and demeanour, he was unmistakably not a local. "Don't do that," he said again.
"Orders, sir," said one of the troopers. "What are you doing out here?"
asked another. Carcassi shook his head and left them alone. He trudged through narrow alleys and open courts, sipping from the spout of the bottle. He found another vacant lot, very similar to the one he had sat down in before, and placed his rump upon a scalene block of basalt. He took out his chapbook and ran through the stanzas he had written. They were terrible. He groaned as he read them, then became angry and tore the precious pages out. He balled the thick cream paper up and tossed it away into the rubble. Carcassi suddenly became aware that eyes were staring at him from the shadows of doorways and windows. He could barely make out their shapes, but knew full well that locals were watching him. He got up and quickly retrieved the balls of crumpled paper he had discarded, feeling that he had no right to add in any way to the mess. He began to hurry down the street as thin boys emerged from hiding to lob stones and jeers after him. He found himself, unexpectedly, in the street of the hostelry again. It was uninhabited, but he was pleased to have found it as his bottle had become unaccountably empty. He went into the gloom. There was no one around. Even the old woman had disappeared. His pile of imperial currency lay where he had left it on the counter. Seeing it, he felt authorized to help himself to another bottle from behind the bar. Clutching the bottle in his hand, he very carefully sat down at one of the tables and poured another drink. He had been sitting there for an indefinite amount of time when a voice asked him if he was all right. Ignis Carcassi blinked and looked up. The gang of Imperial Army troops, who had been burning clean the walls of the city, had entered the hostelry, and the old woman had reappeared to fetch them drinks and food. The officer looked down at Carcassi as his men took their seats.
"Are you all right, sir?" he asked.
"Yes, yes, yes, yes," Carcassi slurred.
"You don't look all right, pardon me for saying. Should you be out in the city?"
Carcassi nodded furiously, tucking into his pocket for his permit. It wasn't there. "I meant to be here," he said instead. "Meant to. I was ordered to come.
to hear Peter Egon Momus present his plans for the new city. That's why I'm here. I'm meant to be.
The officer regarded him cautiously. If you say so, sir. They say Momus has drawn up a wonderful scheme for the reconstruction.
Oh, yes, quite wonderful, Carcassy replied, reaching for his bottle and missing. Quite bloody wonderful. An eternal memorial to our victory here.
Sir?
It won't last, Carcassy said. No, no, it won't last. It can't. Nothing lasts. You look like a wise man to me, friend. What do you think?
I think you should be on your way, sir, the officer said gently.
No, no, no. About the city. The city. It won't last. Terror take Peter Egon Momus to the dust. All things return. As far as I can see, this city was pretty wonderful before we came and hobbled it.
Sir, I think...
No, you don't, Carcassy said, shaking his head. You don't. And no one does. This city was supposed to last forever, but we broke it and laid it in tatters. Let Momus rebuild it. It will happen again. And again. The work of man is destined to perish. Momus said he plans a city that will celebrate mankind forever. You know what? I bet that's what the architects who built this place thought too.
Sir?
What man does comes apart eventually. You mark my words. This city, Momus's city, the Imperium.
Sir, you... Carcassy rose to his feet, blinking and wagging a finger.
Don't, sir, me. The Imperium will fall asunder as soon as we construct it. You mark my words, it's as inevitable as...
Pain abruptly splintered Carcassy's face, and he fell down, bewildered. He registered a frenzy of shouting and movement, then felt boots and fists slamming into him over and over again. Enraged by his words, the troopers had fallen upon him. Shouting, the officer tried to pull them off. Bones snapped. Blood spurted from Carcassy's nostrils.
Mark my words, he coughed. Nothing we build will last forever. You ask these bloody locals.
A boot cap cracked into his sternum. Bloody fluid washed into his mouth. Get off him! Get off him! The officer was yelling, trying to rein in his provoked and angry men. By the time he managed to do so, Ignis Carcassy was no longer pontificating. Or breathing.